Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Spotted at a rally near Wall Street recently, this sign: student loan debt is a national security threat. As the Occupy movement expands, it is beginning to address some issues around economic disparity in this country, and one gaining traction as of late is the Occupy student debt idea. We got a call on this show earlier this week for Paul Krugman about it. We'll play his reaction to the idea in a bit. The nation's cumulative student loan debt surpassed our cumulative credit card debt in 2010. Can you believe it? And it is heading north of $1 trillion. Currently, two-thirds of graduates take out loans, an average of $27,000 a head. For much of this hour, we're going to look at the question of student debt as it stands now. And within the conversation about what to do with that massive debt, there's a bit of a rift. Some say that it's time for a mass default, a general strike by borrowers to stop paying their loans, intentionally default, and send a strong message to banks. That's the Occupy student debt. Others say that default is a dangerous idea, that instead pressure should be applied through Congress to get loan forgiveness. Later this hour, we'll get further into both sides of that divide. But first, Anya Kamenetz, senior writer for Fast Company magazine and author of DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. Her previous book, as you may know, was Generation Debt. Hey, Anya, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great to be here.
What do you make of the student loan issue being taken up by the Occupy movement? Is that a good fit?
Oh, absolutely. I'm totally thrilled by it. I mean, you have this convergence of, a broad awareness of the economic inequalities of our country, and then you have this group of young people who are educated, and yet they realize that they're not facing the opportunities that they thought that they were going to be having, and student loan debt is just a really natural fit. I mean, Wall Street does make a fair amount of money from these loans, and people feel that it's unfair.
How much of a parallel do you see with the mortgage loan crisis? That is to say, the banks gave a lot of mortgages, made a lot of loans that they shouldn't have made because they weren't really taking any risk on those loans. They were bundling them out into securities. Is there a parallel there with student loans being foisted on people who shouldn't actually be taking them?
But the parallel works in two ways. One is that there was, in fact, and has been a secondary market in student loan-backed securities as well, although the size of that market has shrunk, particularly since the Obama administration took over the bulk of the federal student loan program. But the larger issue here is that student loans are extremely safe loans for banks to make because there are no consumer protections on these loans. Bankruptcy protection was removed for all student loans, including private loans, in 2005. And so there's literally no way for the lenders to lose their money. They have incredible power to recuperate their money. And so you could argue that just with the mortgage crisis, that lenders and creditors were not making the responsible decisions or choices. We're looking at actually what is the student's ability to pay back this loan? Is this a reasonable amount of money to be lending someone? Because they don't really have to do that due diligence.
And listeners, let's get your take on this. If you have a large student loan burden, no matter what the dollar amount, call in and tell us what it would mean for you to occupy your debt. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you support the idea of mass default? Would you do it if a million of your fellow borrowers pledged to do it as well as this Occupy student debt movement is trying to encourage? How else have you tried to manage your loans? 212-433-WNYC. And do you think that the responsibility for your excessive debt, if it is excessive debt, is anybody but yours? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Anya, you wrote recently that private student loans, those offered by banks like Citibank and Wells Fargo, are growing three times faster than federal student loans. They're much more expensive, with higher fees and interest rates ranging up to 15%, varying by your creditworthiness. So are there efforts to curb in private as opposed to federal loans?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is a huge gap in the federal policies and even the statements made recently by Arne Duncan and Obama. There's very little help out there for people with private student loans. And without directing, policies and rules at these private loans, they're going to continue to grow out of proportion to federal student loans. They're going to surpass federal student loans very, very soon. And I think that's the real danger coming on the horizon.
You've been on the show before to talk about the Obama administration's efforts to make student loans more transparent and even offer relief for those with huge debt. What's the latest?
Well, last month, and I think, you know, Occupy can claim some credit for this, Obama announced he's going to accelerate people's access to income-based repayment plans where you're going to pay just a certain percentage of your income, your disposable income, as well as public service loan forgiveness. And both of those are going to increase people's ability to get some relief. But again, Brian, they only apply to federal student loans. So the private student loans are still hanging out there, and banks are very unlikely to negotiate with you if you have unaffordable private student loans.
Let's take a phone call. James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You want to push back on this idea of occupying student loans, right?
Yes. I think that actually borrowing for an education is one of the few good, sound reasons to borrow. However, one has to keep in mind what kind of education you're going to be getting and whether you're going to be more economically productive and have higher income as a result of that education, or if you're just going to pursue some non-demand major like in liberal arts where you're not going to make a lot of money. So you have to take into account when you're making your borrowing decisions. For that reason, I also think it's a good idea for the government to subsidize the interest rates on student debt, because all society benefits by any of its members improving their education, knowledge, and productivity. However, this idea that people should just irresponsibly renege on their debts because they made unsound decisions is just not a good idea, and it's not particularly sound when you're saying that the most educated part of our population is really not capable of being responsible for their own decision-making.
So, James,
I mean, if a college-educated class can't make sound economic decisions, then we're really in trouble. So I don't think that we ought to be advocating. But I do think that it ought to be subsidized. It ought not to be in the free market, and the financial institutions mm-hmm. don't always have your interest in mind. And when you're young, you're prone to make less wise decisions than you might after 10 or 20 years in the business world managing your financial affairs.
So James, stay there. I want you to stay there. You've made a lot of good points, and I want to add Johanna in Manhattan to this conversation. Johanna, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian, and thank you so much for having this forum this morning. I work in New York. I live in Brooklyn, and I've been at every single demonstration that has to do with this because I think it's so important. What I love about Anya, I've heard her speak in public, and I've heard her point, which is that what we don't realize is that these terms and structures of loans have changed dramatically. And when someone who is, let's say, from a little bit older generation thinks about student loans and responsibility and paying your debt, they don't understand how these banks have restructured the debt so that they are almost guaranteed to go into default. And that's where the banks want them, because they make more money off of the defaulted loans. So the facts behind this are actually much more scary than sort of what most people try to puzzle out as common sense. So, I even was listening to Inside City Hall the other night, and Earl Lewis was saying, hey, come on, why don't you students just buck up and just pay your debts the way that I did? And he doesn't know what the numbers are. He doesn't know that tuition has gone up 400% since the 1970s, and that there are now asset-backed securities being traded on Wall Street, which are student loan asset-backed securities, and they're worth $10.6 billion. So Wall Street is incentivized to keep people in crippling debt.
All right,
it's
hang on now. Anya and James and Johanna, stay on the line. Anya, first of all, if you need a ghostwriter for your next book, you might want to hire Johanna. She seems to be channeling you.
I'm very, very invested in this issue because I am one of those people with crippling debt.
Yeah. And Johanna, how much debt do you have?
I started out, Brian, with a simple 20, which is the average, I believe. 27 is the average. I have a $23,000 loan for my undergraduate.
Uh-huh.
And what happened, I don't give you my sob story, but I had a brain hemorrhage. I had medical issues, couldn't pay. And basically, the debt has tripled since I took it out, so that right now it's more than almost, it's almost $70,000.
Wow. So,
and those are interest and penalties.
I'm sorry to hear that. So,
that's
Anya,
right.
on her larger point, is, mm-hmm. are the banks, to your knowledge, restructuring these student loans in ways that make default more likely because they make more money that way?
The point is that there's no incentive for the bank to negotiate with you, right? So if you have a mortgage that's become problematic, and I think about 30% of Americans are underwater on their mortgages, you do have that nuclear option of walking away, you know, putting the keys in the mail and getting a foreclosure. And because of the relative freedom of credit in this country, you know, that's a hard decision to make, but it's not going to end you. But for people in situations like Joanna, there is no incentive for the banks to negotiate with you because, as I mentioned, I mean, a federal or even a private student loan is something where they have no bankruptcy protection. So they're not going to necessarily negotiate with you. They're not going to necessarily work out a payment plan. And they're going to roll it up with default and penalties. And I have, you know, I've heard many, many stories of people like Joanna. And I'll tell you, there are lots of mistakes that lenders make in their own favor. And I've never heard of a single lender making a mistake in favor of the borrower. Mm.
But Joanna, to James's point, that if the college-educated class in this country can't figure out how much borrowing is wise and how much is unwise, who can? And shouldn't somebody going to college kind of do a cost-benefit analysis and say, well, you know, if I'm going to be a fine arts major and maybe I'm not going to make that much money in my life, then I better not take out as much in student loans as that chemical engineering major.
Right. I'd love to say that, you know, all of that makes logical sense, but what is missing in that equation is the fact that this country long ago recognized that K through 12 was an imperative, and we made schools public in this country because we believed that that was a right, a human right for every single child in this country, K through 12. What has not been updated is the fact that we now have a knowledge-based economy where K through 12 doesn't cut it, and higher education is an absolute necessity if you are going to make more than minimum wage. So actually, one of the reasons why I like the Occupy Student Debt campaign, which is another one of the organizations, they're just not on your show this morning, but I like the fact that they're talking about reevaluating and asking the question, what kind of a structure in our country do we want to have around education? And don't we deserve, as far as, or don't our kids deserve a complete education? And one of the numbers that was thrown around recently that I heard at one of the speakers were at a rally was that right now to fund public education would only cost $70 billion for higher education in this country, and that it was also reported that the Pentagon yearly loses that amount.
So, James in Manhattan, you want to come back on that?
Yes. I'd like to say that if you get a college education in the last 30 years and going forward into the future, you're likely not to be in the top 1%, but you're likely to be, well, you're not going to be in the top 1% unless you do get a college education, unless you're one of those rare exceptions like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or something. But the point is, you're likely to be a high-income person or a higher-income person. And if on the one hand the high-income people are protesting high tax rates so that these social expenditures on our education are very difficult to make, as well as our health problems and all that, I don't see it. I mean, if the college-educated can't pay for their education to some extent, now I'm saying that it should not be totally on their backs. But it should not be totally free like the K through 12 system. It should be a kind of a mix of, well, if you're going to be successful in life, then you're going to put more, you're going to pay back more, and you're going to get less help from society.
Right.
But you're going to get some help because, as I said earlier, society benefits by your being educated you're going to be paying more.
Anya Kamenetz, you want to come back in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really balanced view, and one scheme that can actually directly do this is actually income contingent repayment. So in Australia, the way the entire higher education financing works is you do not pay up front. You pay a special income tax. People who are university graduates pay a certain income tax. It's a percentage of their income, and there's a very direct relationship then between the benefits that people are getting from higher education, whether they choose to be, you know, in finance or business versus you know, something that's very important to society that doesn't pay as well, like social work or teaching. And then they're simply paying a percentage of their income. So that's a way to really, you know, to distribute both the social and the personal goods that higher education does bring.
I want to thank both our callers, James and Johanna. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
For speaking up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute with Anya Kamenetz on the Occupy student loans movement, and we'll bring in another guest who has a different take on it. He says, well, he doesn't like the idea of a million students just defaulting on their loans as a protest, but he does like the idea of banks offering a lot of loan forgiveness in this era of insane student debt. We'll hear that take and take more of your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we have Henry Louis Gates, who I'm delighted to say will be coming on with us every Thursday this month to talk about his beautiful and epic new book, Upon These Shores, Looking at African-American History, 1513 to 2008. And today we'll start right at the top in 1513, when the first black man to arrive on this continent came not as a slave, but as a conqueror. So Henry Louis Gates coming up with some fascinating history, the beginning of a December-long series with him here on WNYC on The Brian Lehrer Show. Right now we're talking about the Occupy student debt movement. One idea, mass default. There's a movement to urge borrowers to sign a pledge to stop paying their student loans. If 1 million of their fellow borrowers pledge the same, mass default equals mass effect, they say. Well, earlier this week, I was speaking with economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. We got a call from Andrew in Brooklyn, who brought up this mass default idea and said that he thought it would be very dangerous to the U.S. economy if so many people stop paying back their loans to the banks at the same time. Here's Professor Krugman's reaction.
To be honest, I haven't actually done enough homework to figure out what I think. I think the idea that it's a threat to the economy is wrong. It's just not that big a deal in terms of the economy one way or the other. And there's a lot that's wrong with the way we've handled student debt. Basically, we've been using public funds but running them through the private sector for no good reason except to provide some extra profits to the financial industry. But I don't know. It doesn't seem to me to be right to think that all of these loans should be defaulted on. But I don't say that with any conviction because I really haven't done my homework on this one.
Paul Krugman on Monday's show, still with us. Anya Kamenetz, senior writer for Fast Company and author of DIYU and the book Generation Debt. And Anya, what do you hear in the Krugman clip there? As it happens, this clip has become something of a flashpoint in the Occupy student debt movement online since Krugman was here on Monday. Some hear that as an endorsement of the mass default idea, because it wouldn't hurt the economy that much. Some hear it as a dismissal, like it wouldn't have that much impact, just means it wouldn't have that much impact.
Well, from the people that I've talked to within the Occupy Student Debt Campaign, I don't think that their goal is to take down the U.S. economy. I think that they're borrowing, you know, the direct action measures that Occupy has seen in these occupations across the country, and they're basically saying, you know, rather than have a petition or rather than have a legislative appeal, what we'd really like to do is take action here, and we'd like to, you know, create a threat or create a sense of urgency around this very important idea. And I think that they're succeeding in that. You know, I mean, the very fact that they can get someone like a Paul Krugman to discuss it on your show and that we're talking about it right now, I think shows that, you know, they're managing to create a flashpoint around a really important issue.
Let's bring in Robert Applebaum, attorney from Staten Island and former assistant district attorney in Brooklyn. He has a new cause. He's the founder of ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com. Robert Applebaum, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Given the name of your group, I think it's pretty obvious which side of the forgive versus default line you come on. But why make that distinction? If the Occupy movement is saying, okay, let's all default on student debts, and you're saying, no, no, don't default, but let's have the bank forgive the student loans, what's the difference?
Well, first of all, I've been involved in the issue of forgiving student loan debt as a means of economic stimulus for nearly 3 years. So it's not something that I just got involved with. So I've been pushing the notion of student loan forgiveness for that time. And as soon as the Occupy movement started to grow and adopt student loans as one of the issues around which to rally, I started a petition on signon.org, which as now has over 650,000 signatures. I started a petition on the White House's We the People site, and I have the distinction of being the very first petition on that site to receive an official response, which was the president's announcement of pay-as-you-earn last month, which didn't really address the concerns I raised in the petition. But the point is that I advocate working within the law and using the tools at our disposal, legislative action, petitions, and whatnot. I think that by voluntarily defaulting, not only are we putting the borrowers and the participants in this pledge into potential financial danger, but we're also ceding the moral high ground, because there's this perception in America, and a very deep-seated perception, that people should be responsible for the debts they voluntarily incur. And I think the people who follow me largely agree with that. They want to pay back what they borrowed. What they don't want to do is pay back 2, 3, 4, 5 times or more than what they borrowed, especially in light of today's economy where the jobs just aren't available to allow them to repay their loans.
Well, let's bring in another caller who has triple digits worth of student debt. Kelly in Brooklyn. Kelly, you're on WNYC. We really appreciate you speaking up.
Yes. Yes, I have $170,000 in student loan debt.
Yikes. How did you compile that much?
I have a doctorate in clinical psychology, and I had to borrow for my education over a 7-year period. And also my living. I was at a very expensive university. This was in the 90s. And the actual debt was $159,000 that I finished with. But because of interest, it has increased to $170,000.
You owe more today than when you finished your degree?
That's correct.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm someone who's maintained good standing with the student loans. I've never defaulted. I've always, if there were periods of time in which I couldn't pay, I requested forbearances, and all of that accrued interest. But what was a saving grace for me was the income-based repayment program, because before that, I was paying close to $1,000 a month just on the student loan debt. And again, you know, the interest still, even though you're paying that, you're still accruing. You're just paying the interest. You know, you're not even touching the principal.
Right. Is that an Obama program, that income-based?
That the income-based repayment program, because of that, because I have a private practice, so I'm self-employed, it was because of that that I was able to then have my own health insurance. As long as my payment is tied to my income, then it affords me these other benefits like health insurance, the ability to save money, the ability to pay into a retirement account. I actually have more money to contribute, to the economy when they tied it to my income.
Right.
So that was a complete life change for me. And the other thing I wanted to say, just that the social sciences, it's a very expensive degree. It's a very long degree, but the incomes, can be very, very low in the academic. And for clinical psychologists, I work in the court system. I work with a very vulnerable, tough population. I don't get paid for everything that I do. And there's no forgiveness. There's no ability to get credit for choosing to work with a difficult population.
Right. That's an incredible story. And Robert Applebaum, founder of ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com, what words of advice or comfort or, policy proposals would you have for Kelly in Brooklyn?
Well, Kelly and I are pretty much in the same boat. I owe more today than I did on the day I graduated more than 13 years ago. And that's because I served as an assistant district attorney in Brooklyn for 5 years, where I had to put my loans into forbearance. And I saw my loans grow by about $20,000 while I was serving the community. So I can certainly relate to her story. With regard to the Occupy pledge, however, and Paul Krugman's clip from Monday, He said specifically that he doesn't think that this plan would have that great an impact on the economy. What he did not address is the impact that participation in this pledge would have on the borrowers. The point is that there are no consumer protections on any of these loans. There's no bankruptcy protections. There's no statutes of limitations. The lenders can tack on fees and interest and penalties, and you can literally see your amount, principal amount, double, triple, quadruple, and more. So as long as these protections are not in place, anyone who participates in this plan to voluntarily default not only causes us to see the moral high ground and lose public support, but puts themselves into such financial danger that it's akin to financial suicide.
So, Kelly, would you do it if the Occupy movement was successful enough in getting a million's a lot? But there's the, but officially the call is, if, you know, will you default voluntarily on your student loan if a million other people with student loans also agree to do so?
You know, if I were in my 20s, I could probably do that. But as someone in their 40s who has a lot of expenses, I can't afford the consequence, the penalty of what would happen if I were to default. It's something I would certainly consider in my 20s when I could actually recover from the consequences.
Right.
Not something that I could do at this point in my life.
Kelly,
but I like the idea of trying to find a way to punish the banks. But in fact, I think we'll be cutting our, you know,
nose to spite your face. Kelly, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Anya, very briefly, how much of an outlier is Kelly? I'm sure you know, people's eyes were popping out of their heads when they heard she's in her 40s. She's all these years out of grad school. She's got $170,000 in student debt, which is actually more than when she graduated because of the interest, even though she keeps paying her bills.
It's very easy for that to happen. In fact, the president and Michelle did not pay off their law school loans and grad school loans until President Obama sold his first book. So this is something that is affecting people all across the country. And the more education you get, I mean, law school graduates and medical school graduates are facing an average of six figures in loans. And, you know, as good as those degrees are, they don't always guarantee really good employment. And, you know, I don't know how much time we're going to have, but I really want to circle around it and lay part of this at the door of the universities themselves, right? They have failed to control costs. The states have failed to fund public education adequately. This isn't just all about the lenders, and it's not just about the borrowers, but it's about the entire system.
Also joining us now is Kryn Johansen, who is part of the Occupy student debt movement and advocates for mass default. Kryn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I don't know if that's entirely accurate to say, though. I am definitely been writing about the pledge, but I have not, you know,
advocated
come out and advocated for it.
Okay, forgive me.
That's all right.
Under what circumstances do you think it would be a good idea, or what's your basic take?
Well, I think that from my reporting and coverage of it, I think that what they're, in my view, and I take what they're calling for seriously, but I also think that they're trying to shift the rhetoric, especially away from the calls for loan forgiveness, which I have been critical of, and it's more specifically the language, because when you're calling for loan forgiveness, you are basically suggesting that the relationship is balanced, which it's not, and I think Anya would agree with me, especially with what she just said. And also, it sort of assumes that you've done something wrong. And one of my critiques is, you know, these people don't need to get down on their knees to beg for forgiveness because the relationship is completely out of whack. And that's one of the reasons why I have been so intrigued by the pledge and the shift away from this call for loan forgiveness. So for me, it's been more about the rhetoric and bringing attention to a crisis that is at a breaking point.
You heard Robert Applebaum, who's still here, saying that the movement loses its moral high ground if instead of using the system to ask for forgiveness, it looks like all these people being irresponsible.
I disagree. I think that that's not an accurate way of painting it at all. I don't think that it's losing its moral high ground in the least. I think that what they're doing is like, again, as I said, I think they're trying to shift the rhetoric. They're trying to ignite a debate that's very, very important. And that a lot of us have been fighting for years now, and that just continues to get worse.
Robert, you want to come back on this?
Well, I don't believe that Ms. Johansson has any evidence to back up her claim that the pledge doesn't cause us to cede the moral high ground, particularly when all of the responses I've seen come in talk about how while they support the notion of student loan forgiveness through the legislative process and through the systems that we have established, versus taking it upon yourself to voluntarily default and incur all of the fees and penalties that come along with defaulting, since none of the consumer protections that we're trying to have reinstated have yet been reinstated. So anyone participating in this pledge is really engaging in financial suicide. And this notion that if a million people sign, then it's safe for you to default is just a red herring, because there is no strength in numbers when it comes to this. There are no consumer protections on these loans. So what's to stop the lenders from hiring people in India to start signing this petition and get as many people as to pledge as they can so that people actually go through with this? Because as Anya said earlier on in this conversation, the lenders make money when you default.
So, Kren, right and wrong aside, what about this as financial suicide for those who would do it?
Well, again, like I said, I've been covering this closely, and I don't think that – I think what they're trying to do is break out of this sort of – the system in which we have in place. And I don't understand this claim that somehow there's going to be signatures coming from India. I don't really understand the law to that in the least.
Because the lenders want you to default.
Well, you know, there are arguments to be said that that's not accurate, Robert. And
then
I mean, it is true. Excuse me if I may finish. It is true that as you just pointed out, you know, a million people, especially given the fact that there are tens of millions of borrowers. You know, you are correct that a million people is a drop in the bucket, and I've pointed that out in some conversations, because for this to really be effective, let's say, if you were to endorse it and you're to say that, you know, it is a step forward to try to solve the problem, my feeling is we're talking about maybe 15 million people. Mm-hmm. If there's, let's say, my understanding is there's 70 million people with outstanding student loan debt. We're talking about a major, major shift, an agreement, which is huge. And so I don't disagree with Robert on that. But one of the things I've been working with union labor organizers, longtime activists and authors, and discussing this, is an all-out, you know, the possibility right now in theory of a debtors' strike, which is all-inclusive and does not pit the student loan borrower against, let's say, you know, working-class people. And instead, it's trying to reassert ourselves in the system and say, you know what, we don't really like how this is operating anymore. This is something that we want to do. And there's been a lot of talk about this. How can we use union language to assert our power? And as we all know, when unions basically decide to have a general strike, that is a very, very serious thing, and I take that very seriously myself.
We are out of time, and I want to thank Kren Johansson and Robert Applebaum for getting that particular disagreement. You're on the same side in terms of result, but how to get there is obviously a point of serious contention between you. And Anya Kamenetz, author of DIYU, the Occupy Student Debt Movement, very much a topic of discussion. We have more than 100 comments already on our comments page, and folks, you can keep talking about it there all day and into the weekend if you want at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We will continue to talk about it. And I thank all three of you for joining us today and having this important conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we have a college professor up next by way of segue, sort of. It is Henry Louis Gates, who I'm delighted to say will be coming on with us every Thursday this month to talk about his epic new book, Upon These Shores, looking at African-American history, 1513 to 2008. We're going to start right at the beginning, where in 1513, the first black man to arrive on this continent came not as a slave, but as a conqueror. Stay with us for Henry Louis Gates.